Welcome to OncoPharm. I'm your host, John Bazar. I'm a professor of pharmacy practice here at the supporting sponsor of OncoPharm, ETSU's Bill Gatt College of Pharmacy. It is April 3rd, so this should come out tomorrow on the 4th. I'm recording this with my headphones, not my usual microphone that I use in my office, because I am in Tampa, Florida for HOPA's annual conference. Excited for the sessions to start and to network and to meet folks, see former students and residents, is you know, that's the highlight of the meeting. So it'll sound a little different on my headphone mic. And I want to do something, you know, if you're new to the podcast, we do a couple different things here. You know, probably the most common episode is this is kind of what's new in the last couple weeks as far as evidence coming out, because it's so hard to keep up with things in oncology pharmacy. You know, we haven't done these in a while because we've done so many of them, which is going over the bread and butter must know things about oncology drugs. So we've done the cisplat and the doxorubicin and all those years ago. And we'll talk about landmark publications from, you know, years and decades ago. And then also, you know, the bread and butter supportive care topics. And we haven't talked about tumor lysis syndrome on the podcast. So this is a great episode. Well, that remains to be seen. Hopefully it will be a great episode to share with learners new to your station. Maybe can save you some time talking about tumor lysis syndrome, so they can listen to this in 10 minutes and hopefully pretty succinctly know what they need to know. So first, what is tumor lysis syndrome? I talk to, when I do like chemo education, I talk to patients, it's a good news, bad news scenario. So the good news is tumor cells are dying. That's the good news. The bad news is when so many of them die at such a fast rate, they release all their intracellular contents in such a way that it can overwhelm the body. And so those intracellular contents, will start kind of with the easy one, which is potassium, right? So potassium, normal concentration outside the cell is like 4, right? That's why normal potassium is 3.5 to 4. So it's got a really high concentration inside the cell as opposed to sodium, which has a very high concentration outside the cell. So if you release a whole bunch of sodium from all these tumor cells dying, you can get hyperkalemia. We can also see then the release of DNA, right? These cancer cells, they're growing fast. They're making copies of DNA. They get like double DNA in all these cells sometimes. So they release a lot of DNA. So DNA has the phosphate backbone. So you can see hyperphosphatemia. Now, if that phosphate level goes up so high, usually above to the point, say your calcium product gets above 60, you could actually have precipitation of calcium phosphorus. And then you get hypocalcemia, because calcium, as it precipitates with phos, comes out of solution. You have low calcium. And because we're releasing a whole bunch of DNA, pyrimidine, and purine bases, the purine bases in the purine salvage pathway are broken down via the enzyme xanthine oxidase to uric acid. And uric acid doesn't have great solubility, and at really high concentrations, uric acid can precipitate in the kidneys and cause acute kidney injury. Same thing with calcium phosphate precipitation in the kidneys causing acute kidney injury. You don't tend to see, you think of uric acid, high levels of that associated with gout. You don't typically see gouty attacks in people with hyperuricemia and tumor lysis syndrome. So our big concerns here, right, we have 5 electrolyte or 5 labs we're gonna monitor. So potassium can go up, phos can go up, calcium can go down, uric acid can go up, and serum creatinine can go up. And the way tumor lysis syndrome kills people is kidney failure and arrhythmias from the hyperkalemia and or hypocalcemia. So this is the kind of, you know, classic scenario where an ounce of prevention is worth a pound of treatment. But first, we need to identify people who are going to benefit from prevention. We don't just put everybody on drugs to prevent this. So it somewhat intuitively is going to be more likely to happen in tumors that are bigger, so a larger cancer population, and in cancers that are very responsive very quickly to cytotoxic chemotherapy. So those are our acute leukemias and our aggressive lymphomas, with Burkitt's lymphoma being the highest risk, and then you've got your diffuse large B-cell lymphoma or aggressive large cell lymphomas behind Burkitt lymphoma. Those are mostly, we're gonna see that. You can see this in CLL as well, but it's usually hematologic malignancies because they grow fast and they respond well to treatment. There are 2 solid tumors where you kind of think of where you could see tumor lysis syndrome, and that would be germ cell tumors like testicular cancer, very chemosensitive, and small cell lung cancer, also very chemosensitive, especially with higher tumor burden. And a you know, if you have a leukemia, it's pretty easy to assess the tumor burden because their white count will be like 50,000, 140,000. You know, that's a lot of tumor burden. That person's going to have probably some issues with tumor lysis syndrome. It might be a little bit harder with something like small cell lymphoma. Now, you can get the size of the tumor, but we also use lactate dehydrogenase, LDH, as a nonspecific or surrogate marker for tumor burden. As more of those cells turn over and die, they release LDH and that number goes up. So that's kind of how we identify people who would be at risk for tumor lysis syndrome. There are guidelines. I know Bernard Corfier was the lead author on kind of the early guidelines from ASCO that are probably almost two decades old now. And I'm sure all of the supportive care institutions have their own guidelines and individual centers have their own guidelines as well. A lot of the data for tumor lysis syndrome prevention historically comes out of peds because of treating all the ALL in peds. And you can see that in some of the dosing that you'll see and you look up in drug monographs for our agents we use to prevent tumor lysis syndrome. So the first thing we do for prevention are IV fluids. Because if you release a whole bunch of potassium into a big sink versus a smaller sink, that change in concentration will be lower. So this is basically just pre-dilution IV fluids. There was historically a belief that we should do IV fluids that alkalinize the urine that contains sodium bicarbonate because uric acid is an acid. And if you have an alkaline environment, if you go back and do some Henderson-Hasselbalch equation math and calculations, you'll see that if you alkalinize the urine, you're less likely to have uric acid precipitation because more of that uric acid is going to be ionized and therefore unable to precipitate. Two problems with that. One, you know, there hasn't been data showing that, you know, IV fluids with sodium bicarbonate are better than normal saline at preventing, you know, AKI and hyperuricemia or tumor lysis syndrome. And two, some of the metabolites, it's either xanthine or hypoxanthine, actually has a basic pKa, and you might actually favor precipitation of one of those precursors to uric acid. So we just do normal saline is fine as our fluids here. So that's the thing, fluids, okay? And then for many people, allopurinol, which is a xanthine oxidase inhibitor, and that's going to prevent the formation of uric acid. It's not going to do anything to sodium, or not to sodium. Well, it won't do anything to sodium either, but it's not going to do anything to potassium or phosphorus. It's only going to prevent the production of uric acid. You know, if you look up the dosing of allopurinol, you'll see sometimes 300 milligrams per meter squared per dose twice a day. Out of the peds literature, you know, most of us in adults will do 300 once a day or twice a day. And kind of the clinical pearl, you know, this is kind of my, you know, practice. If somebody comes in, you have an idea that they have a high-grade lymphoma or an acute leukemia, start them on allopurinol twice a day right away and really get that uric acid down. And we've been able to use that practice to save requiring to use a more expensive drug in respiratory case. You know, there are some risk of rash and Stephen Johnson's and folks, especially of East Asian descent with allopurinol, that may favor you to maybe use febuxostat instead of allopurinol. But for most people, allopurinol twice a day will suffice. Once a day is probably good for your solid tumor patients as they start. And the risk of tumor lysis syndrome is going to be greatest with the first cycle. So after you debulk these folks, so after you give them 7+3 for AML, you know, as long as they don't have refractory disease, you can probably stop your allopurinol pretty early. It doesn't need to continue through all cycles of chemo because the greatest risk is with that first cycle when the tumor burden is the greatest. Now, so allopurinol and fluids are sufficient for most folks for prevention. The folks at the highest risk, so your acute leukemia patients with white counts above 50 or 100,000, depending on if it's AML or ALL, are at such a high risk, it's probably worth doing empiric respiracase. Probably doing empiric respiracase if they have Burkitt lymphoma too, based on our guidelines. So respiracase is recombinant urate oxidase. It is an enzyme that we as humans do not have. Lots of folks in the animal world, lots of entities in the animal world have urate oxidase, and that that basically turns uric acid into allantoin, which is a very freely excreted in the urine, very soluble byproduct of uric acid. Now, respiracase costs a couple thousand dollars a dose, so whereas allopurinol costs like a couple cents a dose. So, you know, we would like to limit the use of respiracase for our budget as much as we can. The dosing of respiracase by the label, I think, is still 0.15 to 0.2 mgs per kg per dose. And I think it might even be for multiple doses. That comes from the peds literature. If you do 0.15 mg per kg in your typical East Tennessean, you're talking 9, 12, 15 milligrams easily of raspiricase. And now it's not a couple grand, it's like 10 grand a dose. For most patients, a fixed dose of 6 milligrams will suffice. If they are obese, it may not suffice, but you can give them a supplemental 3 or 6 milligram dose the following day if you do not see the resultant drop in uric acid that you want to see. Now, you should see it come down very precipitously. If it goes down to undetectable, especially if it's in a couple hours, your sample of blood may not have been put on ice, which it needs to be to stop the uric acid from being broken down in the tube from the enzyme raspiricase. So you can get an artificially low uric acid level if you don't put that on ice. Literally, put it on ice. There is one potential concern with raspiricase, and that it can cause hemolytic anemia in patients with glucose-6-phosphodehydrogenase or G6PD deficiency. I have seen this once in my career, and it's somewhat problematic when you're giving someone chemotherapy. They're usually already anemic or going to be anemic, and then you have hemolytic anemia on top of that. Fortunately, all these folks are probably getting some steroids as well, which, that won't help. I'm thinking of autoimmune hemolytic anemia. So you just have to kind of do supportive care for those folks. It probably is worth, at least considering testing folks up front for this if you have the time in advance to do so. And a lot of folks can get back actually an activity level of G6PD pretty quickly. Most labs can do that. So you can do that test in folks in advance, especially if you're in an area with a large population of patients of African Asian descent where you see more G6PD deficiency. Raspiricase, again, it lowers uric acid right away. But I do want to caution folks from being so focused on treating the number of uric acid to keep cognizant of why we're trying to prevent hyperuricemia, which is to prevent AKI. I've seen some times where they're on just allopurinol and the uric acid bumps and their uric acid level goes above normal. Goodness, it went to 7. And people flip out because now the lab value is in red. Oh no, the uric acid is high. But their creatinine went down because they're on IV fluids. So we're not having the concern. We're not having AKI. So I would, even if you have a little hyperuricemia while on allopurinol, as long as you're not seeing that creatinine bump, it's probably okay to keep raspiricase in your back pocket when that happens. Now this again comes into the high complexity decision making that has to go into caring for patients because you have to consider their baseline renal function and other factors that go into that. Where are they in their tumor lysis syndrome? If it's a one-day regimen and it's the next day and they're getting no more chemo, you probably certainly don't need raspiricase. If you are day one of like a five-day EPOC, you still have a couple more days of tumor lysis that you expect going forward. So those are things to keep in mind as well with raspiricase. Now, all of those, the allopurinol to prevent a hyperuricemia, raspiricase to prevent or treat it, only affects uric acid. You still need to consider things for hyperkalemia. So your potassium binders like sodium polystyrene, or the new one, sodium zirconium, I think sialylate, brand name's Lokelma. You've got IV fluids, you've got shifters like insulin that can push potassium inside the cell. And then keep in mind too that if you start to get some hyperphosphatemia, you're not just treating hyperphosphatemia, really I look at the calcium phos product. So corrected calcium times phos, if that gets to 55, that's usually my threshold to start a phosphate binder like sevelamer, TID with meals to prevent further hyperphosphatemia. To give you an example, we had a patient one time getting chemo. It was going to the weekend. Phos went up a little bit. Calcium phos product was 50, but it was going to the weekend. And I was like, you know what? Let's just start it. There's not going to be any harm in doing sevelamer TID with meals. And it helped prevent, anyone having to make a decision over the weekend and prevent any further hyperphosphatemia or any bump in the creatinine from calcium phos precipitation. That is, I think that's it for tumor lysis syndrome. So the key takeaway points: prevention, fluids and allopurinol, special circumstances, you consider raspiricase, and then, if you're a trainee, you should expect the question, what would you see in tumor lysis syndrome? And your answer should be hyperkalemia, hyperphosphatemia, hypocalcemia, hyperuricemia, and potentially increase in serum creatinine, kidney injury, and arrhythmias. That's the answer. All right. Thank you for listening. You can follow the podcast on the app, or you can follow me on the app, formerly known as Twitter, @FarmDeetNip, and follow the podcast on X, Threads, and Instagram at OncoFarmPod. And until I talk to you again, remember, doses matter. Thank you.